We don't claim that we're the good housekeeping seal of approval here. We're just providing an opinion on the creditworthiness of the borrower.
A peek behind the curtain at the rating agencies, which keep a close eye on Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state mandates Tesoro to sell some of its gas storage in Anchorage.
What this does is to say, look, we need some competition in the market, because that's really the problem.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Governor Bill Walker's administration is considering major changes to the Alaska LNG project, the effort to build a massive natural gas pipeline from the North Slope. State officials today said the administration is considering increasing the state's stake in the project, or even taking over ownership completely. That would be a radical shift from the structure as it's currently envisioned and blessed by the legislature. Right now, Alaska holds a 25% stake, sharing ownership with the big three North Slope producers, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. Keith Meyer started work as president of the state-owned Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation last week. Meyer says the state would look for outside investors to fund the project.
So this is significantly different than the way it was done. However, it's very similar to the way most of the pipelines in the U.S. have been built, and also the way most of the LNG facilities now have been built.
Meyer says the state is considering the change because the three companies have indicated they may not be ready to move forward next year as low oil prices have cut into their bottom lines. The final project is expected to cost $45 to $65 billion. He stressed nothing has been decided, and the state is still in discussions with its three partners. In his quest to remake Alaska's finances, Governor Bill Walker has found a set of perhaps unexpected allies. They don't live in Alaska. Some of them have never been to Alaska. But they have the power to give Alaska lawmakers an ulcer every time they speak. They are the credit rating agencies. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rachel Waldholtz asks, who are these guys? And how come they have a say in the state's future?
Alaska's credit rating. Like your credit score, this is our calling card in the world of finance. Want to borrow to build a giant natural gas pipeline or refinance our pension obligations? Our credit rating determines whether we can get that money and how much it will cost. This month, the last of the big three agencies revoked Alaska's top-notch credit rating, citing the state's massive budget gap. The downgrades mean it will be more expensive for the state and many Alaska communities to borrow. But Governor Bill Walker argues it's about more than just the money.
It sends a message sort of across the country that there's something wrong with Alaska, that there's something going on in Alaska, that I'm concerned that it would have a chilling effect on investment in our state.
The three major rating agencies have names out of a Harry Potter novel: Moody's, Fitch, Standard & Poor's. But who are the men and women behind the curtain? We called up to find out.
Hello, this is Gabe.
That's Gabe Pettick. He's our analyst, our guy at Standard & Poor's. Pettick is 44. He's based in San Francisco. He's been working on Alaska's credit rating on and off for about a decade. He tracks developments in the state through news reports and financial filings, and then makes the case to a credit committee for how solid we are, or aren't.
We don't claim that we're the good housekeeping seal of approval here. We're just providing an opinion on the creditworthiness of the borrower.
And lately, that opinion has been bearish. S&P was the first agency to downgrade Alaska back in January, knocking us down a notch from AAA to AA+, which, to be clear, is still pretty good. We're better rated than, say, Colorado, and the same as New York, though apparently not as rock solid as Texas. But unless lawmakers find a long-term solution for the budget, that rating is likely to drop. As for what that solution should look like, Pettit claims it's not for him to say. You're not watching the legislature, you know, being like, God, what are you doing, guys?
No, I mean, we're really not. We're really not. And I think sometimes people maybe read into it that way, but we're really not. That's really not what we're about. We're not trying to put our thumb on the scale for any specific policy.
That said, S&P has been pretty explicit about what would change their minds. This spring, they've been very chatty about Alaska, issuing at least 5 reports tracking the state's progress. The main conclusion? Alaska can't cut or tax its way out of the current budget hole. The only way to close the gap and retain the state's current credit rating is something like the governor's plan to restructure the permanent fund.
We can do the math as well as anyone and see that if there's a $4 billion gap and a $5 billion budget, it's pretty tough to make all of those adjustments just through spending cuts or through tax increases.
I do think that Gabe's had his finger on the pulse more than some of the other analysts.
Devin Mitchell is the state debt manager and, for the last 18 years, essentially the steward of our financial reputation. He is not enjoying the current moment. Mitchell says it took 50 years for the state to work its way up to a AAA rating.
It's a very long and hard progression to obtain credit rating increases. And to have a diminishment of that credit rating at this point is disheartening because I recognize that it's going to be a difficult course to reverse.
With interest rates at historic lows, Mitchell says the issue isn't so much what it will cost the state in the short term. The fear is what comes next. In early June, S&P warned it could lower the state's rating again within 90 days if lawmakers don't act. That warning came just about a week before a version of the governor's permanent fund plan died in the Alaska House. Pettick says a second downgrade would be pretty unusual.
For a state government to go down more than one notch in a year signals that there's pretty serious fiscal stress.
As for relieving that stress, Governor Walker has called another special session for this summer, so lawmakers will have a chance to try again. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
The survivors of law enforcement officers and firefighters who die in the line of duty continue to face uncertainty over health insurance. That's because the two houses of the legislature couldn't agree on a bill to provide benefits during the recent special session. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
State Trooper Sergeant Patrick Scott Johnson was just 2.5 years from ensuring that his family would have health benefits through age 65 when he and Trooper Gabe Rich were killed in a shooting in 2014. This left Johnson's widow, Brandy, fearful she would lose health coverage. Since then, the administrations of Governor Sean Parnell and Bill Walker have extended insurance to the survivors of Johnson Rich and Trooper Tage Toll, who died in a helicopter crash in 2013. And while they'll have coverage through next June, Johnson says it's uncertain beyond then.
It's frustrating. I am not the type of person to ask for things, but this is something that my husband would have earned for our family. And for me to have to ask for something that I feel he's already earned, it's kind of humiliating in a way.
She and the other family supported legislation that would make this coverage permanent, saying they were doing it for future survivors of those who die in the line of duty. The legislature failed to pass that bill in the regular session that ended in May, so Governor Walker included it in his call for the first special session this year. House Bill 4002 would limit benefits to surviving spouses for 10 years or remarriage, and to children until age 19 or 23 for college students. The House passed it 34-0 on Saturday and adjourned. But senators in the majority caucus say the House gave them no time to review what it had done. And since the House left Juneau, the Senate wouldn't have been able to make changes. So the Senate adjourned on Sunday without passing the bill. This procedural disagreement upset survivors. Toll's widow, Nikki Toll, says the two houses should have worked together.
Politics is a fickle thing, and we're the ones learning. And it's hard to put into words that frustration.
Walker decided against including the bill in his call for another special session starting on July 11th. A spokeswoman said the session is limited to those bills directly related to the governor's fiscal plan. Johnson says Walker should have added the bill to the session, considering how close it was to passing. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel says the Senate supports the governor's actions to provide benefits to survivors. and she noted the legislature provided funding for the benefits in the budget starting July 1st. But she says the Senate wasn't given time to work on the bill.
The Senate was prohibited from making any changes in the bill or having any input into it because of the fact that the House had adjourned.
Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Garrett expresses concern about what the inability to pass the bill would mean for the special session when the legislature will work on more contentious issues.
If you take any signals from the Senate Republican refusal to pass the easiest bill to help survivors of killed troopers and firefighters and police, you know, it's a dysfunctional place where bills are getting blocked, even the easy ones. So that's going to be a tough lift.
Giesel says it was the Senate that led the work on major bills that passed this year, including reforms to criminal justice and Medicaid that will save the state money. If Walker doesn't add the bill to the special session agenda, the legislature won't be able to consider it again until next session in January. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating the first consecrated Buddhist temple in Alaska.
They believe that if they do that, then, you know, in the next life, they will have a, you know, good life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Under pressure from the state, Tesoro has agreed to sell one of its two fuel storage terminals at the Port of Anchorage to avoid having a monopoly over the gasoline market in Alaska's rail belt. Chief Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen says the state began investigating after Tesoro announced it planned to buy the Flint Hills tank farm at the Anchorage port. In addition to its Anchorage storage facilities, Tesoro also owns the state's only gasoline-producing refinery in Kenai. Sniffen says the state was concerned the purchase of more fuel storage capacity would allow Tesoro to shut out competition.
And our conclusion was it probably would. It would allow them to exercise some market power over the sale of gasoline that we were uncomfortable with.
The State Department of Law today released terms of the agreement, which is subject to a 60-day public comment period and the approval of a superior court judge. The agreement says Tesoro has a year to find a buyer, and if it can't, it must lease the terminal.
It's huge. I mean, I think it's really critical that they did it.
State Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, has been pressing the state to investigate Tesoro's dominance of Alaska's gasoline market.
We have the refiners right here. We have most of the oil comes right from Alaska. We've got the lowest gasoline taxes in the nation, yet we often have the highest gasoline prices in the nation. And so what this does is to say, look, we need some competition in the market, because that's really the problem.
Willikowski says the sale of one terminal would allow a competitor to bring in fuel from a lower 48 refinery. It would be a fraction of the market demand, but the senator says he thinks it's sufficient to keep Tesoro's prices in check. Tesoro declined an interview request, but said in an email the sale of the terminal will allow it to proceed with the Flint Hills purchase, which it describes as a great opportunity for Alaska and Tesoro. For the first time in Alaskan history, a Thai Buddhist temple in Anchorage was fully consecrated or made holy. It was a landmark event for Buddhists from the state and around the world. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman attended the ceremony.
A monk from Thailand speaks to the packed small sanctuary over a mic. People spill out the door, smartphones held high, trying to get photos of the monks in their deep orange robes. They respond in unison to his words and actions. They're watching the official consecration of the temple when the room on the side of an old log house in Midtown Anchorage transforms from a human space for prayer and meditation to a holy space the Buddha can enter. The temple has been there for 20 years, but before it could only be used for limited purposes, like meditation. During the ceremony, 9 granite balls, called Loknimit, are buried around the sides and center of the temple to mark the sacred space. In the hallway by the door, One of the balls is suspended over a hole. It's covered in bits of gold leaf and coins held on with Vaseline. Cholata Jarupkorn, who comes to Wat Alaska Yanavararam to meditate, says donating is an honor.
They believe that if they do that, then, you know, in the next life they will have a, you know, good life, or even this life, you know, like you're doing a good, you know, good deed.
And it has other perks.
Because the name of that stone is Luknimit. It's like you can always make a wish.
So did you make a wish?
Yes.
Yes. You don't want to share, do you?
I just want to have a happy life.
The ball has been hanging over the hole for more than 2 years now, waiting for the official consecration. And finally, it's time. Suki Edmonds from Thailand approaches the ball with an ornate curved blade and starts hacking away the thin, dried vines that hold it up. The ball drops into the hole. Edmonds' excitement is palpable. Even when the crowd wanders away, she has trouble finishing her sentences.
I'm so happy. That's all. So happy. Look at my wife. You can talk.
Edmonds says she traveled almost 24 hours just for the three-day event. Only one temple is consecrated per year in this sect of Buddhism. This year it's in Alaska. Next year in Arkansas. The event attracts lay people and monks from around the world. Edmonds and her friends raised more than $4,000 for the temple and for the honor of releasing the ball.
This has happened. This is first. This is lifetime. It might be first time in my life. In the lifetime, I say I can doing this.
The ceremony also marked the first time that Buddhist monks could be officially ordained in Alaska. Seven soon-to-be monks gather in the temple for their ordination, dressed all in white. Before changing into their official orange robes, they must accept the 227 rules of their new lives. Pensari Bunswane, a temple ambassador from North Carolina, says becoming a monk is a great honor for the men and their families, but it's not easy.
Thou shalt not kill, not steal, not commit adultery, or in this case, no sex, and not lie, or not talk too much, or not use the bad word, and no drinking, and cannot eat after 12, and also they cannot sing, dance.
Many of the new monks are old men who gave up their previous lives, including marriages, in order to be ordained. Two of them will stay in Alaska with the monks who already live at the Wat. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
On August 16th, the Crystal Serenity will sail from Seward on a historic trip. It will be the first big luxury liner to travel through the Northwest Passage, stopping in Kodiak, Unalaska, and Nome, before cruising through Canada's far north to Greenland and then south to New York. The unprecedented voyage is generating excitement and some trepidation. Alaska Public Media's Graylin Brashear reports.
Cruise ships have been plying Arctic waters for years, but the Crystal Serenity will be the largest by far to chart a course through the Northwest Passage. The luxury ship will carry more than 1,000 passengers and 620 crew on a journey that will take an estimated 32 days and starts at a cost of about $22,000 a head. It marks a turning point for tourism in the Arctic, which has seen a steady increase in ship traffic as a warming planet yields more and more ice-free water in summer. For some, it's an exciting shift. In Nome, Harbor Master Lucas Stott says there's a lot of enthusiasm for the arrival of the ship, which will actually have to moor offshore because it's too big for the harbor.
For us, 800 to 1,000 passengers is an awful lot of folks coming ashore when we're used to seeing pocket-sized cruise ships or the expeditionary cruises that have anywhere between 100 and 200 people on board only.
Others are looking on the unprecedented trip with more caution. The big concern, say conservationists, is safety. Mounting a mass rescue operation or containing an oil spill thousands of miles from the nearest deepwater port is difficult. The Coast Guard has been planning for a potential mass casualty event in the Arctic for years and will conduct a drill near Nome shortly after the Crystal Serenity leaves. But there are other concerns about impacts to a fragile and stressed Arctic environment and to the native communities who rely on it. Andrew Hartzig is the director of the Ocean Conservancy's Arctic program. He says cargo ships are usually looking for the shortest, easiest routes, but that's not necessarily the case for cruise ships.
A
tourism company is often seeking out the, you know, the very places that are kind of most dramatic, because that's what the passengers want to see.
We want to be the cruise line that sets the example for how to do this and how to do it right.
That's John Stoll, the Crystal VP in charge of managing the Northwest Passage voyage. He says the company has been carefully planning this trip for 3 years. The ship's been outfitted with all kinds of high-tech ice-detecting equipment. And once it's in Canadian waters, an icebreaker on loan from Great Britain will act as a support ship, sending up helicopters for real-time ice recon. Stoll says Crystal has also planned carefully to minimize impacts. They'll be exceeding international guidelines on wastewater discharge, he says, and they've been working with the tiny Arctic towns they'll visit to make sure they don't overwhelm the communities.
I think Crystal, from a standpoint, has an obligation to do what we can to introduce the world to this part of the world. It's phenomenal, and it's something that people shouldn't miss.
Still, some are concerned about what Crystal's trip heralds. Austin Amasek is with the Kowarik Corporation's marine program, which aims to give a voice to native villages as the world continues to talk about increasing Arctic traffic. He says there's reason to worry about tourism's impact on subsistence resources.
People in north, you know, northwestern Alaska on the coast, we've been mariners for a very long time, and we make, you know, substantial use of the marine environment for subsistence food items, for our culture, and for living, and it is very important to us.
Despite that, he says, it's easy for Native communities to be left out of the conversation about the opening of the Arctic.
We want to make sure that, you know, the environment is not damaged. We want to make sure that our communities are able to sustain themselves. And we want to be able to participate in some decision-making.
When it comes to this trip, Hartzig from the Ocean Conservancy and others were quick to say that Crystal Cruises has done a solid job of planning. But they say they worry about other operators who will come along later. It's a mixed bag, says Hartzig. The only reason tourism can happen so far north is because of a warming climate. But maybe that fact will inspire visitors to care more about the Arctic.
For a lot of people, the Arctic is out of sight and out of mind. And if you have vessels like this taking people up to the Arctic to see firsthand this environment, maybe that will be the thing that really registers with people.
There is at least a lot of interest. According to Crystal, the Serenity is sold out for this sailing and is filling up for another trip in 2017. In Anchorage, I'm Graylin Brashear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arcadis, helping Alaskan owners with construction project management for over 22 years, from planning to completion. Learn more by calling 276-8095. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The driver of a passenger van that crashed on the remote Aleutian island of Atka, killing three passengers, has been charged with three counts of manslaughter. A warrant has been issued for the arrest of 28-year-old Sonny Iloilo, who is also charged with six counts of felony assault and driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Alaska State Troopers on June 14th received notice that a van carrying 10 people had crashed in Atka. The crash killed 43-year-old Ray McCulloch Jr., 51-year-old Mike Tunahan Jr., and 57-year-old Paul Nicholas Nesbitt, and injured the other seven in the van. Troopers say the van drifted off the road, and the driver overcorrected, causing the van to roll several times. The National Park Service has two top-level jobs open in Alaska right now. Both Katmai National Park and Reserve out of King Salmon and the Western Arctic National Parklands in Kotzebue are hiring for new superintendents. And as KDLG's Hannah Colton reports, the Park Service is pushing for more Alaska natives and locals to apply for those positions.
When Adrian Fleek joined the National Park Service as the Alaska Native Affairs Liaison a year ago, she and some colleagues decided to take a hard look at the demographics of who the Park Service employs.
So we gathered some statistics, you know, 20% of the population of Alaska is American Indian or Alaska Native, and yet at the National Park Service, we only employ about 4% of that group. So we're very underrepresented.
Fleek says higher-ups within the Park Service are recognizing the value in hiring homegrown land managers rather than people who come from outside the state. That's due in part to people like Jeanette Kolsch. She's a Nome native who a few years ago became superintendent of the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve. Fleek says Kolsch's familial and cultural ties in the region allowed her to become more effective more quickly.
She has an ability to connect with the tribes in the area and local constituents. People understand they can trust her. And she also understands that the tribes in the community have that government-to-government relationship. And so I've seen that she's been able to do a high level of consultation on any land management issue. So it's a really big success story, I think, of getting that local involvement.
Fleek hopes that high-level employees like Kolsch will in turn inspire more locals and Alaska Natives to apply to jobs at all levels of the Park Service. But she realizes there are many barriers, including an application with job requirements that might seem intimidating. Her advice to local applicants? Fleek says go ahead and brag about any and all experience that shows your management abilities.
If you didn't have the exact experience they're describing, you may have had something really similar, like maybe you haven't done law enforcement planning, but you've done subsistence resource planning, some very similar efforts. So go ahead and put that into your comprehensive resume, which it's very different than the private sector, where you're supposed to be brief and have one or two pages of a resume. And in the U.S. government, it's supposed to be as comprehensive as possible.
The deadline to apply for the head positions at Katmai and Western Arctic is Thursday, June 23rd. You can find those applications at usajobs.gov. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholz, Graylin Brashear, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Hannah Colton in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.